Now we return to Napoleon Hill's original text. The character of a great leader. During the World War, I was fortunate enough to listen to a great soldier's analysis of how to be a leader. This analysis was given to the student officers of the second training camp at Fort Sheridan by Major C.A. Bach, a quiet, unassuming Army officer acting as an instructor. I have preserved a copy of this address because I believe it to be one of the finest lessons on leadership ever recorded. The wisdom of Major Bach's address is so vital to the business person aspiring to leadership, or to the section boss, or to the clerk, or to the foreman of the shop, or to the president of the company, that I have preserved it as a part of this course. It is my earnest hope that this remarkable dissertation on leadership will find its way into the hands of every employer and every worker and every ambitious person who aspires to leadership in any walk of life. The principles upon which the address is based are as applicable to leadership in business and industry and finance as they are in the successful conduct of warfare. Major Bach spoke as follows. In a short time, each of you men will control the lives of a certain number of other men. You will have in your charge loyal but untrained citizens who look to you for instruction and guidance. Your word will be their law. Your most casual remark will be remembered. Your mannerisms will be aped. Your clothing, your carriage, your vocabulary, your manner of command will be imitated. When you join your organization, you will find there a willing body of men who ask from you nothing more than the qualities that will command their respect, their loyalty, and their obedience. They are perfectly ready and eager to follow you so long as you can convince them that you have these qualities. When the time comes that they are satisfied you do not possess them, you might as well kiss yourself goodbye. Your usefulness in that organization is at an end. How remarkably true this is in all manner of leadership. From the standpoint of society, the world may be divided into leaders and followers. The professions have their leaders. The financial world has its leaders. In all this leadership, it is difficult, if not impossible, to separate from the element of pure leadership, that selfish element of personal gain or advantage to the individual, without which any leadership would lose its value. It is in military service only where men freely sacrifice their lives for a faith, where men are willing to suffer and die for the right or prevention of a wrong, that we can hope to realize leadership in its most exalted and disinterested sense. Therefore, when I say leadership, I mean military leadership. In a few days, the great mass of you men will receive commissions as officers. These commissions will not make you leaders, they will merely make you officers. They will place you in a position where you can become leaders if you possess the proper attributes. But you must make good, not so much with the men over you as with the men under you. Men must and will follow into battle officers who are not leaders, but the driving power behind these men is not enthusiasm, but discipline. They go with doubt and trembling that prompts the unspoken question, what will he do next? Such men obey the letter of their orders, but no more. Of devotion to their commander, of exalted enthusiasm that scorns personal risk, of self-sacrifice to ensure his personal safety, they know nothing. Their legs carry them forward because their brain and their training tell them they must go. Their spirit does not go with them. Great results are not achieved by cold, passive, unresponsive soldiers. They don't go very far, and they stop as soon as they can. Leadership not only demands but receives the willing, unhesitating, unfaltering obedience and loyalty of other men, and a devotion that will cause them, when the time comes, to follow their uncrowned king to hell and back again, if necessary. You will ask yourselves, of just what, then, does leadership consist? What must I do to become a leader? What are the attributes of leadership, and how can I cultivate them? Leadership is a composite of a number of qualities, just as success is a composite of the factors out of which this course was built. Among the most important, I would list self-confidence, moral ascendancy, self-sacrifice, paternalism, fairness, initiative, decision, dignity, courage. Self-confidence results first from exact knowledge, second, the ability to impart that knowledge, and third, the feeling of superiority over others that naturally follows. All these give the officer poise. To lead, you must know. You may bluff all of your men some of the time, but you can't do it all of the time. Men will not have confidence in an officer unless he knows his business, and he must know it from the ground up. The officer should know more about paperwork than his first sergeant and company clerk put together. He should know more about messing than his mess sergeant, more about diseases of the horse than his troop farrier. He should be at least as good a shot as any man in his company. If the officer does not know and demonstrates the fact that he does not know, it is entirely human for the soldier to say to himself, "To hell with him. He doesn't know as much about this as I do," and calmly disregard the instructions received. There is no substitute for accurate knowledge. Become so well informed that men will hunt you up to ask questions, that your brother officers will say to one another, "Ask Smith. He knows." And not only should each officer know thoroughly the duties of his own grade, but he should study those of the two grades next above him. A twofold benefit attaches to this. He prepares himself for duties that may fall to his lot any time during battle. He further gains a broader viewpoint, which enables him to appreciate the necessity for the issuance of orders and join more intelligently in their execution. Not only must the officer know, but he must be able to put what he knows into grammatical, interesting, forceful English. He must learn to stand on his feet and speak without embarrassment. I am told that in British training camps, student officers are required to deliver 10-minute talks on any subject they choose. That is excellent practice. For to speak clearly, one must think clearly, and clear, logical thinking expresses itself in definite, positive orders. While self-confidence is the result of knowing more than your men, moral ascendancy over them is based upon your belief that you are the better man. To gain and maintain this ascendancy, you must have self-control, physical vitality, and endurance and moral force. You must have yourself so well in hand that even though in battle you be scared stiff, you will never show fear. For if by so much as a hurried movement, or a trembling of the hands, or a change of expression, or a hasty order hastily revoked, you indicate your mental condition, it will be reflected in your men in a far greater degree. In garrison or camp, many instances will arise to try your temper and wreck the sweetness of your disposition. If at such times you fly off the handle, you have no business to be in charge of men. For men in anger say and do things that they almost invariably regret afterward. An officer should never apologize to his men. Also, an officer should never be guilty of an act for which his sense of justice tells him he should apologize. Another element in gaining moral ascendancy lies in the possession of enough physical vitality and endurance to withstand the hardships to which you and your men are subjected, and a dauntless spirit that enables you not only to accept them cheerfully, but to minimize their magnitude. Make light of your troubles, belittle your trials, and you will help vitally to build up within your organization an esprit whose value in time of stress cannot be measured. Moral force is the third element in gaining moral ascendancy. To exert moral force, you must live clean. You must have sufficient brain power to see the right and the will to do right. Be an example to your men. An officer can be a power for good or a power for evil. Don't preach to them. That will be worse than useless. Live the kind of life you would have them lead, and you will be surprised to see the number that will imitate you. A loudmouth, profane captain who is careless of his personal appearance will have a loudmouth, profane, dirty company. Remember what I tell you. Your company will be the reflection of yourself. If you have a rotten company, it will be because you are a rotten captain. Self-sacrifice is essential to leadership. You will give all the time. You will give of yourself physically for the longest hours, the hardest work, and the greatest responsibility are the lot of the captain. He is the first man up in the morning and the last man in at night. He works while others sleep. You will give of yourself mentally in sympathy and appreciation for the troubles of men in your charge. This one's mother has died, and that one has lost all his savings in a bank failure. They may desire help, but more than anything else, they desire sympathy. Don't make the mistake of turning such men down with a statement that you have troubles of your own, for every time you do that, you knock a stone out of the foundation of your house. Your men are your foundation, and your house of leadership will tumble about your ears unless it rests securely upon them. Finally, you will give of your own slender financial resources. You will frequently spend your own money to conserve the health and well-being of your men or to assist them when in trouble. Generally, you get your money back. Very frequently, you must charge it off to profit and loss. Even so, it is worth the cost. When I say that paternalism is essential to leadership, I use the term in its better sense. I do not now refer to that form of paternalism that robs men of initiative, self-reliance, and self-respect. I refer to the paternalism that manifests itself in a watchful care for the comfort and welfare of those in your charge. Soldiers are much like children. You must see that they have shelter, food, and clothing, the best that your utmost efforts can provide. You must see that they have food to eat before you think of your own. You must be far more solicitous of their comfort than of your own. You must look after their health. You must conserve their strength by not demanding needless exertion or useless labor. And by doing all these things, you are breathing life into what would be otherwise a mere machine. You are creating a soul in your organization that will make the mass respond to you as though it were one man. And that is esprit. When your organization has this esprit, you will wake up some morning and discover that the tables have been turned, that instead of your constantly looking out for them, they have, without even a hint from you, taken up the task of looking out for you. You will find that a detail is always there to see that your tent, if you have one, is promptly pitched, that the most and cleanest bedding is brought to your tent, that from some mysterious source 2 eggs have been added to your supper when no one else has any, that an extra man is helping your men give your horse a super grooming, that your wishes are anticipated, that every man is Johnny on the spot, and then you have arrived. You cannot treat all men alike. A punishment that would be dismissed by one man with a shrug of the shoulders is mental anguish for another. A company commander who, for a given offense, has a standard punishment that applies to all is either too indolent or too stupid to study the personalities of his men. In his case, justice is certainly blind. Study your men as carefully as a surgeon studies a difficult case. And when you are sure of your diagnosis, apply the remedy. And remember that you apply the remedy to effect a cure, not merely to see the victim squirm. It may be necessary to cut deep, but when you are satisfied as to your diagnosis, don't be diverted from your purpose by any false sympathy for the patient. Hand in hand with fairness, in awarding punishment, walks fairness in giving credit. Everybody hates a human hog. When one of your men has accomplished an especially creditable piece of work, see that he gets the proper reward. Turn heaven and earth upside down to get it for him. Don't try to take it away from him and hog it for yourself. You may do this and get away with it, but you will have lost the respect and loyalty of your men. Sooner or later, your brother officers will hear of it and shun you like a leper. In war, there is glory enough for all. Give the man under you his due. The man who always takes and never gives is not a leader. He is a parasite. There is another kind of fairness, that which will prevent an officer from abusing the privileges of his rank. When you exact respect from soldiers, be sure you treat them with equal respect. Build up their manhood and self-respect. Don't try to pull it down. For an officer to be overbearing and insulting in the treatment of enlisted men is the act of a coward. He ties the man to a tree with the ropes of discipline and then strikes him in the face, knowing full well that the man cannot strike back. Consideration, courtesy, and respect from officers toward enlisted men are not incompatible with discipline. They are parts of our discipline. Without initiative and decision, no man can expect to lead. In maneuvers, you will frequently see, when an emergency arises, certain men calmly give instant orders which later, on analysis, prove to be, if not exactly the right thing, very nearly the right thing to have done. You will see other men, in emergency, become badly rattled. Their brains refuse to work, or they give a hasty order, revoke it, give another, revoke that, in short, show every indication of being in a blue funk. Regarding the first man, you may say, that man is a genius. He hasn't had time to reason this thing out. He acts intuitively. Forget it. Genius is merely the capacity for taking infinite pains. The man who is ready is the man who has prepared himself. He has studied beforehand the possible situations that might arise. He has made tentative plans covering such situations. When he is confronted by the emergency, he is ready to meet it. He must have sufficient mental alertness to appreciate the problem that confronts him and the power of quick reasoning to determine what changes are necessary in his already formulated plan. He must also have the decision to order the execution and stick to his orders. Any reasonable order in an emergency is better than no order. The situation is there. Meet it. It is better to do something and do the wrong thing than to hesitate, hunt around for the right thing to do, and wind up doing nothing at all. And, having decided on a line of action, stick to it. Don't vacillate. Men have no confidence in an officer who doesn't know his own mind. Occasionally, you'll be called upon to meet a situation that no reasonable human being could anticipate. If you have prepared yourself to meet other emergencies that you could anticipate, the mental training you have thereby gained will enable you to act promptly and with calmness. You must frequently act without orders from higher authority. Time will not permit you to wait for them. Here again enters the importance of studying the work of officers above you. If you have a comprehensive grasp of the entire situation and can form an idea of the general plan of your superiors, that and your previous emergency training will enable you to determine that the responsibility is yours and to issue the necessary orders without delay. The element of personal dignity is important in military leadership. Be the friend of your men, but do not become their intimate. Your men should stand in awe of you, not in fear. If your men presume to become familiar, it is your fault and not theirs. Your actions have encouraged them to do so. And, above all things, don't cheapen yourself by courting their friendship or currying their favor. They will despise you for it. If you are worthy of their loyalty and respect and devotion, they will surely give you all these without asking. If you are not, nothing that you can do will win them. It is exceedingly difficult for an officer to be dignified while wearing a dirty, spotted uniform and a 3-day stubble of whiskers on his face. Such a man lacks self-respect, and self-respect is an essential of dignity. There may be occasions when your work entails dirty clothes and an unshaved face. Your men all look that way. At such times, there is ample reason for your appearance. In fact, it would be a mistake to look too clean. They would think that you were not doing your share, but as soon as this unusual occasion has passed, set an example for personal neatness. And then I would mention courage. Moral courage you need as well as mental courage. That kind of moral courage which enables you to adhere without faltering to a determined course of action, which your judgment has indicated is the one best suited to secure desired results. You will find many times, especially in action, that after having issued your orders to do a certain thing, you will be beset by misgivings and doubts. You will see, or think you see, other and better means for accomplishing the object sought. You will be strongly tempted to change your orders. Don't do it until it is clearly manifested that your first orders were radically wrong. For if you do, you will be again worried by doubts as to the efficacy of your second orders. Every time you change your orders without obvious reason, you weaken your authority and impair the confidence of your men. Have the moral courage to stand by your order and see it through. Moral courage further demands that you assume the responsibility for your own acts. If your subordinates have loyally carried out your orders and the movement you directed is a failure, the failure is yours, not theirs. Yours would have been the honor had it been successful. Take the blame if it results in disaster. Don't try to shift it to a subordinate and make him the goat. That is a cowardly act. Furthermore, you will need moral courage to determine the fate of those under you. You will be frequently called upon for recommendations for promotion or demotion of officers and non-commissioned officers in your immediate command. Keep clearly in mind your personal integrity and the duty you owe your country. Do not let yourself be deflected from a strict sense of justice by feelings of personal friendship. If your own brother is your second lieutenant and you find him unfit to hold his commission, eliminate him. If you don't, your lack of moral courage may result in the loss of valuable lives. If, on the other hand, you are called upon for a recommendation concerning a man whom, for personal reasons, you thoroughly dislike, do not fail to do him full justice. Remember that your aim is the general good, not the satisfaction of an individual grudge. I am taking it for granted that you have physical courage. I need not tell you how necessary that is. Courage is more than bravery. Bravery is fearlessness, the absence of fear. The merest dolt may be brave because he lacks the mentality to appreciate his danger. He doesn't know enough to be afraid. Courage, however, is that firmness of spirit, that moral backbone, which, while fully appreciating the danger involved, nevertheless goes on with the undertaking. Bravery is physical. Courage is mental and moral. You may be cold all over. Your hands may tremble. Your legs may quake. Your knees be ready to give way. That is fear. If, nevertheless, you go forward, if, in spite of this physical defection, you continue to lead your men against the enemy, you have courage. The physical manifestations of fear will pass away. You may never experience them but once. They are the buck fever of the hunter who tries to shoot his first deer. You must not give way to them. A number of years ago, while taking a course in demolitions, the class of which I was a member was handling dynamite. The instructor said, regarding its manipulation, "I must caution you gentlemen to be careful in the use of these explosives. One man has but one accident. And so I would caution you, if you give way to the fear that will doubtless beset you in your first action, if you show the white feather, if you let your men go forward while you hunt for a shell crater, you will never again have the opportunity of leading those men. Use judgment in calling on your men for displays of physical courage or bravery. Don't ask any man to go where you would not go yourself. If your common sense tells you that the place is too dangerous for you to venture into, then it is too dangerous for him. You know his life is as valuable to him as yours is to you. Occasionally, some of your men must be exposed to danger that you cannot share. A message must be taken across a fire-swept zone. You call for volunteers. If your men know you and know that you are right, you will never lack volunteers, for they will know your heart is in your work, that you are giving your country the best you have, that you would willingly carry the message yourself if you could. Your example and enthusiasm will have inspired them. And lastly, if you aspire to leadership, I would urge you to study men. Get under their skins and find out what is inside. Some men are quite different from what they appear to be on the surface. Determine the workings of their mind. Much of General Robert E. Lee's success as a leader may be ascribed to his ability as a psychologist. He knew most of his opponents from West Point days, knew the workings of their minds, and he believed that they would do certain things under certain circumstances. In nearly every case, he was able to anticipate their movements and block the execution. You cannot know your opponent in this war in the same way, but you can know your own men. You can study each to determine wherein lies his strength and his weakness. Which man can be relied upon to the last gasp and which cannot? Know your men, know your business, know yourself. And this concludes Major Bach's address to his student officers. Napoleon Hill resumes as follows. In all literature, you will not find a better description of leadership than this. Apply it to yourself, or to your business, or to your profession, or to the place where you are employed, and you will observe how well it serves as your guide. Major Bach's address is one that might well be delivered to every boy and girl who graduates from high school. It might well be delivered to every college graduate. It might well become the book of rules for every person who is placed in a position of leadership over others, no matter in what calling, business, or... Make bold decisions quickly. In Lesson 2, in Volume 1 of The Law of Success, you learn the value of a definite chief aim. Here, I want to emphasize that your definite aim will never be anything else but a mere wish unless you become a person of initiative and aggressively and persistently pursue that aim until it has been fulfilled. Your aim must be active and not passive. You can get nowhere without persistence, a fact that cannot be too often repeated. The difference between persistence and lack of it is the same as the difference between wishing for a thing and positively determining to get it. To become a person of initiative, you must form the habit of aggressively and persistently following the object of your definite chief aim until you acquire it. Whether this requires 1 year or 20 years, you might as well have no definite chief aim as to have such an aim without continuous effort to achieve it. You are not making the most of this course if you do not take some step each day that brings you nearer realization of your definite chief aim. Do not fool yourself or permit yourself to be misled to believe that the object of your definite chief aim will materialize if you only wait. The materialization will come through your own determination, backed by your own carefully laid plans and your own initiative in putting those plans into action, or it will not come at all. One of the major requisites for leadership is the power of quick and firm decision. Analysis of more than 16,000 people disclose the fact that leaders always make ready decisions, even in matters of small importance, while followers never make quick decisions. This is worth remembering. The follower, in whatever walk of life you find him, is a person who seldom knows what he or she wants. The follower vacillates, procrastinates, and actually refuses to reach a decision even in matters of the smallest importance, unless the leader induces him to do so. To know that the majority of people cannot and will not reach decisions quickly, if at all, is of great help to the leader who knows what he wants and has a plan for getting it. Here it will be observed how closely allied are the two laws covered by Lesson 2 and this lesson. The leader not only works with a definite chief aim, but he has a very definite plan for attaining the object of that aim. It will be seen also that the law of self-confidence becomes an important part of the working equipment of the leader. The chief reason why the follower does not reach decisions is that he lacks the self-confidence to do so. Every leader makes use of the law of a definite chief aim, the law of self-confidence, and the law of initiative and leadership. And if he is an outstanding, successful leader, he makes use also of the laws of imagination, enthusiasm, self-control, pleasing personality, accurate thinking, concentration, and tolerance. Without the combined use of all these laws, no one may become a really great leader. Omission of a single one of these laws lessens the power of the leader proportionally. A salesman for the LaSalle Extension University called on a real estate dealer in a small western town for the purpose of trying to sell the realtor a course in salesmanship and business management. When the salesman arrived at the prospective student's office, he found the gentleman pecking out a letter by the two-finger method on an antiquated typewriter. The salesman introduced himself, then proceeded to state his business and describe the course he had come to sell. The realtor listened with apparent interest. After the sales talk had been completed, the salesman hesitated, waiting for some signs of yes or no from his prospective client. Thinking that perhaps he had not made the sales talk quite strong enough, he briefly went over the merits of the course he was selling a second time. Still, there was no response from the prospective student. The salesman then asked the direct question, "You want this course, do you not?" In a slow, drawling tone of voice, the realtor replied, "Well, I hardly know whether I do or not." No doubt he was telling the truth, because he was one of the millions who find it hard to reach decisions. Being an able judge of human nature, the salesman then arose, put on his hat, placed his literature back in his briefcase, and made ready to leave. Then he resorted to tactics that were somewhat drastic and took the realtor by surprise with this startling statement. "I'm going to take it upon myself to say something to you that you will not like, but it may be of help to you. Take a look at this office in which you work. The floor is dirty, the walls are dusty, the typewriter you are using looks as if it might be the one Mr. Noah used in the ark during the big flood. Your pants are bagged at the knees, your collar is dirty, your face is unshaved, and you have a look in your eyes that tells me you're defeated. Please, go ahead and get mad. That's just what I want you to do, because it may shock you into doing some thinking that will be helpful to you and to those who are dependent upon you. I can see, in my imagination, the home in which you live. Several little children, none too well dressed, and perhaps none too well fed. A mother whose dress is three seasons out of style, whose eyes carry the same look of defeat that yours do. This woman whom you married has stuck by you, but you have not made good in life as she had hoped when you were first married that you would. Please remember that I am not now talking to a prospective student, because I would not sell you this course at this particular moment if you offered to pay cash in advance, because if I did, you would not have the initiative to complete it, and we want no failures on our student list. The talk I am now giving to you will make it impossible, perhaps, for me ever to sell you anything, but it is going to do something for you that has never been done before, providing it makes you think. Now, I will tell you in a very few words exactly why you are defeated, why you are pecking out letters on an old typewriter in a dirty old office in a little town. It is because you do not have the power to reach a decision. All your life you have been forming the habit of dodging the responsibility of reaching decisions, until you have come now to where it is well nigh impossible for you to do so. If you had told me that you wanted the course, or that you did not want it, I could have sympathized with you, because I would have known that the lack of funds was what caused you to hesitate. But what did you say? Why, you admitted you did not know whether you wanted it or not. If you will think over what I have said, I'm sure that you will acknowledge that this has become a habit with you to dodge the responsibility of reaching clear-cut decisions on practically all matters that affect you. The realtor sat glued in his chair, with his underjaw dropped, his eyes bulged in astonishment, but he made no attempt to answer the biting indictment. The salesman said goodbye and started for the door. After he had closed the door behind him, he again opened it, walked back in, and with a smile on his face, took his seat in front of the astonished realtor and explained his conduct. "I do not blame you at all if you feel hurt at my remarks. In fact, I sort of hope that you have been offended. But now let me say this, face to face, that I think you have the intelligence and I'm sure you have the ability, but you have fallen into a habit that has whipped you. Nobody is ever down and out until he is under the sod. You may be temporarily down, but you can get up again, and I am just sportsman enough to give you my hand and offer you a lift if you'll accept my apologies for what I have said. You do not belong in this town. You would starve to death in the real estate business in this place, even if you were a leader in your field. Get yourself a new suit of clothes, even if you have to borrow the money with which to do it. Then go over to St. Louis with me, and I'll introduce you to a real estate agent who will give you a chance to earn some money and, at the same time, teach you some of the important things about this line of work that you can later capitalize on. If you haven't enough credit to get the clothes you need, I will stand good for you at a store in St. Louis where I have a charge account. I am in earnest, and my offer to help you is based upon the highest motive that can actuate a human being. I am successful in my own field, but I have not always been so. I went through just what you are now going through, but the important thing is that I went through it and got it over with, just as you are going to do if you will follow my advice. Will you come with me?" The realtor started to arise, but his legs wobbled and he sank back into his chair. Despite the fact that he was a great big fellow, a He-Man type, his emotions got the better of him and he actually wept. He made a second attempt and got back on his feet, shook hands with the salesman, thanked him for his kindness, and said he was going to follow the advice, but he would do so in his own way. Calling for an application blank, he signed for the course on salesmanship and business management, made the first payment in nickels and dimes, and told the salesman he would hear from him again. 3 years later, this realtor had an organization of 60 salesmen and one of the most successful real estate businesses in the city of St. Louis. I have been in this realtor's office many times and have observed him over a period of more than 15 years. He is an entirely different human being from the person interviewed by the LaSalle salesman over 15 years ago. And the thing that made him different is the same that will make you different. It is the power of decision that is so essential to leadership. This realtor is now a leader in the real estate field. He is directing the efforts of other salesmen and helping them to become more efficient. This one change in his philosophy has turned temporary defeat into success. Every new salesperson who goes to work for him is called into his private office before going to work and told the story of his own transformation, word for word, just as it occurred when the LaSalle salesman first met him in his shabby little real estate office. Some 18 years ago, I made my first trip to the little town of Lumberport, West Virginia. At that time, the only means of transportation leading from Clarksburg, the largest nearby center, to Lumberport was the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, or an interurban electric line which ran within 3 miles of the town. One could walk the 3 miles if he chose. Upon arrival at Clarksburg, I found that the only train going to Lumberport in the forenoon had already gone, and not wishing to wait for the later afternoon train, I made the trip by trolley, with the intention of walking the 3 miles. On the way down, the rain began to pour, and those 3 miles had to be navigated on foot through deep yellow mud. When I arrived at Lumberport, my shoes and pants were muddy, and my disposition was none the better for the experience. The first person I met was V.L. Horner, who was then cashier of the Lumberport Bank. In a rather loud tone of voice, I asked of him, "Why do you not get that trolley line extended from the junction over to Lumberport so your friends can get in and out of the town without drowning in mud?" "Did you see a river with high banks at the edge of the town as you came in?" he asked. I replied that I had seen it. "Well," he continued, "that's the reason we have no streetcars running into town. The cost of a bridge would be about $100,000, and that is more money than the company owning the trolley line is willing to invest. We've been trying for 10 years to get them to build a line into town." "Trying," I exploded. "How hard have you tried?" "We have offered them every inducement we could afford, such as a free right-of-way from the junction into the town and free use of the streets. but that bridge is the stumbling block. They simply will not stand the expense. Claim they cannot afford such an expense for the small amount of revenue they would receive from the 3-mile extension. Then the law of success philosophy began to come to my rescue. I asked Mr. Horner if he would take a walk over to the river with me, that we might look at the spot that was causing so much inconvenience. He said he would be glad to do so. When we got to the river, I began to take inventory of everything in sight. I observed that the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad tracks ran up and down the riverbanks on both sides of the river, and that the county road crossed the river on a rickety wooden bridge, both approaches to which were over several strands of railroad track, as the railroad company had its switching yards at that point. While we were standing there, a freight train blocked the crossing and several teams of horses stopped on both sides of the train, waiting for an opportunity to get through. The train kept the road blocked for about 25 minutes. With this combination of circumstances in mind, it required but little imagination to see that three different parties were or could be interested in the building of the bridge, such as would be needed to carry the weight of a streetcar. It was obvious that the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad Company would be interested in such a bridge because that would remove the county road from their switching tracks and save them a possible accident on the crossing, to say nothing of much loss of time and expense in cutting trains to allow the wagon teams to pass. It was also obvious that the county commissioners would be interested in the bridge because it would raise the county road to a better level and make it more serviceable to the public. And, of course, the Street Railway Company was interested in the bridge, but it did not wish to pay the entire cost. All these facts passed through my mind as I stood there and watched the freight train being cut for the traffic to pass. A definite chief aim took place in my mind. Also, a definite plan for its attainment. The next day, I got together a committee of townspeople consisting of the mayor, councilmen, and some leading citizens, and called on the division superintendent of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad Company at Grafton. We convinced him that it was worth 1/3 of the cost of the bridge to get the county road off his company's tracks. Next, we went to the county commissioners and found them to be quite enthusiastic over the possibility of getting a new bridge by paying for only 1/3 of it. They promised to pay their 1/3, providing we could arrange for the other 2/3. We then went to the president of the traction company that owned the trolley line at Fairmont and laid before him an offer to donate all the rights of way and pay for 2/3 of the cost of the bridge, providing he would begin building the line into town promptly. We found him receptive also. 3 weeks later, a contract had been signed between the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad Company, the Monongahela Valley Traction Company, and the county commissioners of Harrison County, providing for the construction of the bridge, 1/3 of its cost to be paid by each. 2 months later, the right-of-way was being graded and the bridge was underway, and 3 months after that, streetcars were running into Lumberport on regular schedule. This incident meant much to the town of Lumberport because it provided transportation that enabled people to get in and out of the town without undue effort. It also meant a great deal to me because it served to introduce me as one who got things done. Two very definite advantages resulted from this transaction. The chief counsel for the traction company gave me a position as his assistant, and later on, it was the means of an introduction that led to my appointment as the advertising manager of the LaSalle Extension University. Lumberport, West Virginia was then, and still is, a small town, and Chicago was a large city and located a considerable distance away. But news of initiative and leadership has a way of taking on wings and traveling. 4 of the 17 laws of success were combined in the transaction described, namely, a definite chief aim, self-confidence, imagination, and initiative and leadership. The law of doing more than paid for also entered somewhat into the transaction because I was not offered anything and in fact did not expect pay for what I did. To be perfectly frank, I appointed myself to the job of getting the bridge built more as a sort of challenge to those who said it could not be done than I did with the expectation of getting paid for it. By my attitude, I rather intimated to Mr. Horner that I could get the job done, and he was not slow to snap me up and put me to the test. It may be helpful to call attention here to the part that imagination played in this transaction. For 10 years, the townspeople of Lumberport had been trying to get a streetcar line built into town. It must not be concluded that the town was without citizens of ability, because that would be inaccurate. In fact, there were many able people in the town, but they had been making the mistake which is so commonly made by us all, of trying to solve their problem through one single source, whereas there were actually 3 sources of solution available to them. $100,000 was too much for one company to assume for the construction of a bridge, but when the cost was distributed between three interested parties, the amount to be borne by each was more reasonable. The question might be asked, why did not some of the local townsmen think of this three-way? In the first place, they were so close to their problem that they failed to take a prospective bird's-eye view of it, which would have suggested the solution. This also is a common mistake, and one that is always avoided by great leaders. In the second place, these townspeople had never before coordinated their efforts or worked as an organized group with the sole purpose in mind of finding a way to get a streetcar line built into town. This also is another common error made by people in all walks of life, that of failure to work in unison, in a thorough spirit of cooperation. I, being an outsider, had less difficulty in getting cooperative action than one of their own group might have had. Too often there is a spirit of selfishness in small communities that prompts each individual to think that his idea should prevail. It is an important part of the leader's responsibility to induce people to subordinate their own ideas and interests for the good of the whole. And this applies to matters of civic, business, social, political, financial, or industrial nature. Success, no matter what may be one's conception of that term, is nearly always a question of one's ability to get others to subordinate their own individualities and follow a leader. The leader who has the personality and the imagination to induce his followers to accept his plans and carry them out faithfully is always an able leader. The next lesson on imagination will take you still further into the art of tactful leadership. In fact, leadership and imagination are so closely allied and so essential for success that one cannot be successfully applied without the other. Initiative is the moving force that pushes the leader ahead, but imagination is the guiding spirit that tells him which way to go. Imagination enabled me to analyze the Lumberport Bridge problem, break it up into its three component parts, and assemble these parts in a practical working plan. Nearly every problem may be so broken up into parts which are more easily managed as parts than they are when assembled as a whole. Perhaps one of the most important advantages of imagination is that it enables one to separate all problems into their component parts and to reassemble them in more favorable combinations. It has been said that all battles in warfare are won or lost not on the firing line after the battle begins, but back of the lines, through the sound strategy or lack of it used by the generals who planned the battles. What is true of warfare is equally true in business, and in most other problems which confront us throughout life. We win or lose according to the nature of the plans we build and carry out. A fact that serves to emphasize the value of the laws of initiative and leadership, imagination, self-confidence, and a definite chief aim. With the intelligent use of these four laws, one may build plans, for any purpose whatsoever, which cannot be defeated by any person or group of persons who do not employ or understand these laws. There is no escape from the truth here stated. Organized effort is effort that is directed according to a plan that was conceived with the aid of imagination, guided by a definite chief aim, and given momentum with initiative and self-confidence. These four laws blend into one and become a power in the hands of a leader. Without their aid, effective leadership is impossible. Intolerance, an after-the-lesson visit with the author. If you must give expression to prejudice and hatred and intolerance, do not speak it, but write it. Write it in the sands, near the water's edge. When the dawn of intelligence shall spread over the eastern horizon of human progress, and ignorance and superstition shall have left their last footprints on the sands of time, it will be recorded in the last chapter of the book of humanity's crimes that our most grievous sin was that of intolerance. The bitterest intolerance grows out of religious, racial, and economic prejudices and differences of opinion. How long, O God, until we poor mortals will understand the folly of trying to destroy one another because we are of different religious beliefs and racial tendencies? Our allotted time on this earth is but a fleeting moment. Like a candle we are lighted, shine for a moment, and flicker out. Why can we not learn to so live during this brief earthly visit that when the great caravan called death draws up and announces this visit completed, we will be ready to fold our tents and silently follow out into the great unknown without fear and trembling? I am hoping that I will find no Jews or Gentiles, Catholics or Protestants, Germans, Englishmen or Frenchmen, when I shall have crossed the bar to the other side. I am hoping that it will find there only human souls, brothers and sisters all, unmarked by race, creed, or color, for I shall want to be done with intolerance so I may rest in peace throughout eternity. There is a famous picture that, to my mind, perfectly describes the futility of combat. Two male deer have engaged in a fight to the finish, each believing that he will be the winner. Off at the side, a doe awaits the victor, little dreaming that tomorrow the bones of both combatants will be bleaching in the sun. 20 years ago, a great educational institution was doing a thriving business and rendering a worthy service to thousands of students. The two owners of the school married two beautiful and talented young women who were especially accomplished in the art of piano playing. The two wives became involved in an argument as to which one was the more accomplished in this art. The disagreement was taken up by each of the husbands. They became bitter enemies. Now the bones of that once prosperous school lie bleaching in the sun. In one of the great industrial plants, two young managers locked horns because one received a promotion which the other should have had. For more than 5 years, the silent undertow of hatred and intolerance showed itself. Those who worked under each of them became inoculated with the spirit of dislike that they saw cropping out of their superiors. Slowly, the spirit of retaliation began to spread over the entire plant. The employees became divided into little cliques. Production began to fall off. Then came financial difficulty and finally bankruptcy for the company. Now, the bones of a once prosperous business lie bleaching in the sun, and the two managers and several thousand others were compelled to start all over again in another field. In a fashionable suburb of Philadelphia, certain people of wealth have built their homes. The word intolerance might just as well be inscribed on each door. One owner builds a high steel fence in front of the house. The neighbor, not to be outdone, builds a fence twice as high. Another buys a new motor car, and the next door neighbor goes one better by purchasing two new cars. One remodels, adding a colonial-style porch. Another adds a new porch and a Spanish-style garage for good measure. The big mansion on the top of the hill gives a reception that brings a long line of cars filled with people who have nothing in particular in common with the host. Then follows a series of receptions all down the Gold Coast line, each trying to outshine all the others. Andrew Carnegie and Henry C. Frick did more than any other two men to establish the steel industry. Both made millions of dollars for themselves. Then came the day when economic intolerance sprang up between them. To show his contempt for Frick, Carnegie built a tall skyscraper and named it the Carnegie Building. Frick retaliated by erecting a much taller building alongside of the Carnegie Building, naming it the Frick Building. These two gentlemen locked horns in a fight to the finish. Carnegie lost his mind, and perhaps more, for all we of this world know. What Frick lost is known only to himself and the keeper of the great records. In memory, their bones lie bleaching in the sun of posterity. Poverty has some advantages. It never drives those who are poverty-stricken to lock horns in the attempt to out-poverty their neighbors. Wherever you see people with their horns locked in conflict, you may trace the cause of the combat to one of the three causes of intolerance: religious difference of opinion, economic competition, or sexual competition. The next time you observe two people engaged in any sort of hostility toward each other, just close your eyes and think for a moment, and you will be surprised at how much they begin to resemble two deer with their horns locked over a doe, a religious emblem, or a pile of gold. 17 factors enter into the attainment of success. One of these is tolerance. The other 16 are mentioned many times in this series of lessons. Intolerance binds our legs with the shackles of ignorance and covers our eyes with the scales of fear and superstition. Intolerance closes the book of knowledge and writes on the cover, "Open not this book again. The last word has been herein written." It is not your duty to be tolerant, it is your privilege. Remember, as you listen to this article, that sowing the seed of intolerance is the sole and exclusive business of some. All wars and all other forms of human suffering bring profit to some. If this were not true, there would be no wars or other similar forms of hostility. When you feel yourself preparing to lock horns with someone, remember that it will be more profitable if you lock hands instead. A handshake leaves no bones, bleaching in the sun. Love is the only bow on life's dark cloud. It is the morning and the evening star. It shines upon the cradle of the babe and sheds its radiance upon the quiet tomb. It is the mother of art, inspirer of poet, patriot, and philosopher. It is the air and light of every heart, builder of every home, kindler of every fire on every hearth. It was the first to dream of immortality. It fills the world with melody, for music is the voice of love. Love is the magician, the enchanter that changes worthless things to joy and makes right royal kings and queens of common clay. It is the perfume of the wondrous flower, the heart, and without that sacred passion, that divine swoon, we are less than beasts. But with it, earth is heaven, and we are gods. Ingersoll. Cultivate love for your fellow human being, and you will no longer want to lock horns with him in futile combat. Love makes each of us our brother's keeper. Love, indeed, is light from heaven, a spark of that immortal fire, with angels shared, by Allah given, to lift from earth our low desire. Devotion wafts the mind above, but heaven itself descends in love, a feeling from the Godhead caught, to wean from self each sordid thought. A ray of him who formed the whole, a glory circling round the soul. There are 20 qualities that leaders must possess. Rubber-spined people will have no part in the leadership of the future. They will have been supplanted because they lacked the qualities essential for leadership at a time when the whole country was literally bleeding to death because of poor leadership. Following is the list of qualities that leaders of the future must possess. You will find it helpful to stop the recording now and get a sheet of paper on which to list these qualities. Number 1. Complete mastery over the 6 basic fears. Number 2. Willingness to subordinate personal interests for the good of their followers. Complete mastery over avarice and greed. Number 3. Singleness of purpose, represented by a definite program of leadership which harmonizes with the needs of the times. Number 4. Understanding and application of the mastermind principle, through which power may be achieved through coordination of effort in a spirit of harmony. Number 5. Self-confidence in its highest form. Number 6. Ability to reach decisions quickly and stand by them firmly. Number 7. Imagination sufficient to enable them to anticipate the needs of the times and to create plans for supplying those needs. Number 8. Initiative in its keenest form. Number 9. Enthusiasm and the ability to transmit it to their followers. Number 10. Self-control in its highest form. Number 11. A willingness to render more service than that for which direct compensation is received. Number 12. A pleasing magnetic personality. Number 13. The ability to think accurately. Number 14. The ability to cooperate with others in a spirit of harmony. Number 15. The persistence to concentrate thoughts and efforts upon a given task until it has been completed. Number 16. The ability and hindsight to profit by mistakes and failures. Number 17. Tolerance in its highest form. Number 18. Temperance in all of its forms. Number 19. Intentional honesty of both purpose and deed. Number 20. Last, but by no means least, strict adherence to the golden rule as the basis of all relationships with others. This may appear to be a formidable list of qualities with which the leader of the future must be equipped, but time will prove that those leaders who endure will possess and make use of every one of these qualities. Casual examination of the list will disclose the fact that the leaders of the future will be compelled to avoid the mistakes of the leaders of the past, the chief of which has been exploitation of their followers. great fortunes accumulated at the expense of the masses will not be among the possessions of the leaders of the future. Wise beyond room for comparison will be the aspirant to future leadership who realizes that no business or profession of the future may be successfully conducted without recognition of the fact that the followers and patrons of that business or profession are partners in it, and, as such, are entitled to share in the benefits to be derived from. Editor's Commentary. If you think that sounds like pie-in-the-sky optimism, let me offer you an example. Sam Walton. At his death in 1992, Sam Walton was the richest person in America, worth $28 billion. He made that fortune through his Walmart stores providing everyday necessities to everyday people. Walton's customers benefited from his business because it provided them with the things they needed at lower prices than any other store. They also benefited from shopping in a place where the clerks were friendly and eager to help. That spirit was a direct result of Walton's dedication to working hard alongside his employees. He would show up on loading docks late at night with bags of donuts for his crews, jump up on tables at store openings, and lead the staff in a cheer, and once paid up on a dare to them to bring in improved profits by doing the hula dance down Wall Street. Walton also shared the company's wealth very generously, paying yearly bonuses in the company's valuable stock. People who were committed to Walmart were repaid with retirement accounts that, even for sales clerks, could be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. It may have cost Walton a little more up front, but it earned him an unbelievable return in terms of the enthusiasm of his employees. As noted earlier, the latter part of the 20th century saw the publication of numerous books on management theory that echoed much of what Napoleon Hill proposed in The Law of Success. Returning to Napoleon Hill's original text. Before taking up the next lesson, it may be helpful if you take inventory of yourself and determine your rating on the 20 qualities of leadership. Self-analysis is always beneficial, provided the analysis is accurate. Every essential for leadership can be cultivated by any person who makes a reasonable effort to apply the Law of Success philosophy. If you wish to be certain that your self-analysis is accurate, give yourself a rating on the 20 qualities of leadership and then have it checked by two or three people who know you well enough to judge you accurately. A simple method of rating yourself is this. After each of the 20 qualities of leadership that you listed previously on your sheet of paper, write the word perfect, fair, or poor. Perfect will entitle you to a rating of 5%. Fair will entitle you to a rating of 2.5%, and poor should be rated as 0. Place these figures on your analysis sheet and add them. If the total gives you an average rating of less than 75%, you will know that you are not yet passable as a leader in your chosen occupation. This chart will disclose where you are weak. Mastery of this philosophy will provide all you need with which to eliminate or bridge your weakness. This self-analysis should be made before you pass on to the next lesson, because it will help you get more from that and all of the other lessons that follow. Remember, as you make this analysis, that its purpose is to let you see yourself as you are, through eyes that are dependable and friendly. You are now ready for the lesson on imagination. Listen to that lesson with a thought in mind of all that has been here stated, and it will take on a deeper meaning.